The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them a light has shone. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace.
Advent 2020, such an interesting year. And Advent is what we need right now. Now, what even is Advent? Literally, the word is the arrival of a notable person or thing. So you think about like the advent of television, the advent of the radio. It's not the invention of something, it's the arrival of a thing. If you think of the movie Arrival, aliens coming down to Earth, contacting us, communicating with us, that's what Advent is. And of course, Christmas is about the arrival of Jesus into the world, God becoming human. And the church for hundreds of years has celebrated that event with a month of building up to that great day, that great moment, Christmas Eve, where God becomes a human being, with these themes that kind of build up to that amazing miracle, and what all of that has to then do with us and how we live our lives. And so the themes of hope, faith, joy, and peace, that's what we're going to be going through, and what all of that, how it affects our lives. The fact that Jesus became human, yes, but what does it mean for you and me? Because it's one thing to watch the news and go, okay, there's an event that happened. There's this fact that took place, or maybe there's an accident on this bridge. But it's another to do something about it, to take a different route, to change your life in light of a truth. And that's what these weeks are about. So there's the miracle, that beautiful, wonderful thing, but then how it's life-changing for us. That's what this season is about. And so what we've done the last 3 weeks has kind of prepped us for this, right? 3 weeks exploring all of this concept of John's prologue. You might feel like you got like a degree in theology for those 3 weeks as we went through it. But now it's the implication of all that. We had said the word became flesh and dwelt among us. We beheld his glory, glory of the only begotten. But now what does that mean for us? Meaning if this actually happened, and it's not a myth, it's not a legend, it's not a dream, then what are four crazy, amazing things it does for us in our life as we live it, everyday life stuff? So this first week, the prophecy candle, the theme of hope. The candle symbolizes hope, the expectation of the coming of the Messiah. That's what this week is about. The expectation of a thing that will happen in the future that will change everything for the good. That's what expectation is. Probably the best example for us in our experience is like having a kid, right? The wife gets pregnant, her belly starts to grow, she starts liking ice cream a lot and going out to the store at midnight, the husband is, to get her stuff, all right? Just maybe my experience. But especially with that first kid, you know, you're super excited because it's going to change everything, right? Not that the other kids aren't exciting, you're all exciting, but it's like you've lived this free life where you do whatever you want and there's this kid coming and you know it's going to be so much love and so much joy and so much fun, and it can't come soon enough, right? Aaron and I, we were not patient people. So Aaron was getting bigger and I'm like, come on, let's go. And then we would talk to the doctors. We're like, we think it's ready. We think it's ready. It's like, guys, it's been a month. Chill out, all right? It ain't ready yet. You need that thing in there for a while. But all of us kind of like, let's go. I want to see this kid. I want to see its eyeballs and its little nose. I want to like smell, you know, baby smell. Oh my goodness. And for the world before Jesus, it was this expectation. The belly was growing and it was like, let's go. There's a king that's supposed to come and make all things new. The world was a mess. It was filled with evil and sin and death running the world. Like we have this text that we read, Isaiah chapter 9, spoke of that moment. It said, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. It's amazing. That text was written 700 years before Jesus Christ arrived on planet Earth. So think about like 700 years before right now, this moment, 2020 is 1320. All right, so that's like, so picture, that's like Braveheart days. All right, there was no running water. There's no anything. All right, that's how long ago. And he's saying there's gonna, it's describing the state of life back then, 700 years before Jesus. And what does he say about it? He says it was dark. The people walked in darkness, he says. And I think it's difficult for us to comprehend how hopeless the world was before the first Christmas. The Jews were under the iron boot of Rome. Their leaders were corrupt. Their worship was empty and sterile. The people were discouraged. God had promised the Messiah. And then they hadn't heard from a prophet. Remember Malachi? For 400 years. So it had been dead silence. It seemed like the heavens were silent. God was silent. There was, in a sense, they were running out of hope. And here's the first thing for us that we got to learn for our life. God is like that sometimes. He just takes too long. He is what theologians actually call, I remember one of my seminary professors said, he's the 3-mile-an-hour God, right? So you right now, whatever situation you're in, you're like, where's that break I'm going to get in life? When am I going to find the one? When am I going to be successful? When am I going to be healed of that thing? When are things going to turn around for me? It just seems to take forever. And what we got to understand is the bubble under this story starts to tell us there's a reason for that, though, because God's going to get it just right. At the right time, the right person, in the right place. Remember, God's main aim is not to give you what you want, but what you need. What you need for what, though? To become more like Jesus. Romans 8 says that's God's will for your life. Now, that's not always an easy life. There's seasons of pain and isolation that we all go through. You feel that right now? Pain, isolation, unsure about the future. Remember, that was Jesus' life. And we see that, and we read that, and we admire it. But then when we go through it, we're like, yeah, Jesus, you can kind of keep that part, right? We're feeling that right now. Maybe you can't be with the family you're always with this time of year, and you've been isolated from them, and you can't go to be with. It's a crazy year, and it stinks for sure. But here's what we got to know. Jesus is still on the throne, and he's coming into the world to change it, to change you, to change me. So let's look for that. And during this season, let it change us, just like Christmas did. Isaiah 9 said they walked in darkness. That's us. That's our world. That's our culture, right? Let me know a day that isn't filled with bad news around the world. It's depressing. You turn on the news, you read the news. That's our lives. But here's the thing. When you're in darkness, all you want to do is what? You want to see. You want light to come out. My dog sometimes wakes me up at 3 o'clock in the morning and goes, I want to go out. I got to go out. I got to go out. I got to go pee. So I stumble out of my bed and kind of come down the stairs. And I usually walk through my kitchen to let her out the back. And the other night, 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm walking. I just slam my foot against something the kids left on the ground. I'm like, all I want in this moment is a light so I can see. See, humankind is lost in sin, in isolation. It's miserable. And we're starting to wonder whether life will ever be good sometimes. Will it be good with my family? Will it be good with my friends? What about my job? What about, can I find meaning again? Can I find love again? Can I find joy again? The world seems like Narnia, right? Always winter and never Christmas. That's what Lewis says about the land of Narnia. How terrible is that? That's the state of their soul, Isaiah says, and ours, similar to us. We have running water, we have technology, we have beautiful houses. It seems like everything's good, but even then, think about it, depression's on the rise, loneliness is on the rise. Life expectation, the expectancy of how long we live, actually the amount of years dropped for the first time in hundreds of years this year in the United Kingdom. How long someone lives, the average person in the United Kingdom, dropped. That's crazy. Because it's dark. Why? For the same reason that in World War II, in the concentration camps, you know, Jews are getting all rounded up, and the difference between those who made it and those who gave up and died in there, like in themselves, is the same reality with our life. And it was one thing, hope. See, that was the difference. people, when you read books about World War II and the concentration camps and the experience that they had, the people who had hope, they're gonna come for us. Don't worry, tomorrow we're gonna get saved. Don't worry this. They kept going, and it's the people who gave up in their spirit. See, what causes darkness? Having no hope, that things will never get better, right? That's what makes you give up. If right now you were told that you're never gonna get out of your house again, this is just it, it's locked down forever, get used to it, we would lose it, right? We would freak out, because what is that? That's no hope. That was Israel in a sense. They're getting tired of like, when is this light gonna come? See, because on the other hand, there's a kind of life that comes from hope that you can't explain, but it's everything. It's what gets you out of bed in the morning. I think beyond love, it may be the thing we most need in our life. I got a biblical verse for that if you challenge it. 1 Corinthians 13, you know, the wedding passage where grandma's up there going, love is this, love is that. Right at the end of that passage, it says, and so in the end, there is faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. But what's the second greatest? Paul doesn't tell us. I think it's hope. It's like oxygen. It's what wakes us up when we feel 1,000 pounds and we just feel life bearing down on us. Hope is the thing that gets us to go, okay, I can take another step. I can face another day. I can face another thing. Think back, Star Wars, 1977. Why is that movie so powerful? What's it called? A New Hope. Right? Why is that powerful? Because the empire's ruling, no one is free, and what they need is a new hope. And what is that new hope? That there's gonna be one that's gonna come and save everybody. He's gonna come out of hiding. It's Luke Skywalker. That's the new hope. Hope gives us life. It's like a future reason to keep going in the present. So one day a friend recently was describing a situation with his wife to me, and she's going under treatment and so on. And he kept saying, you know, this and this and this, but by August, things will be better. By August, everything's gonna turn around. By August, see, what is that? Without that, what is there? You're just staring at a situation. See, what these people in Isaiah ended up having in the end that kept them going is they're saying it's dark, but there's a light coming. So the question for all of us is, what should that hope then be? What should give you ultimate hope in life? We use a lot of things. We use our beauty. If I could become more beautiful, I'm gonna have hope and meaning and joy and purpose in my life. Some of us, it's your intelligence. If I could become smarter and look smarter. For some of you, it's being successful. Others of you, it's being rich. We get sold on hope a lot every single day. Every commercial we see when we're scrolling or watching TV, it's the new car, it's the vacation, it's the new makeup. All these things are gonna give you hope for the good life. If you get that right job, you get that right spouse, if you get the kids worked out, if you get more money, if you become successful, then you will have arrived and you can have hope for the future and meaning and purpose and joy. And we know that stuff doesn't ultimately give hope. It was in what the text says. They have seen a great light, it says, shone on them. One of the first indications of the Christmas season in our lives, in our culture, is the appearance of lights, right? Every year a guy comes and puts lights on my house and it just looks sick, right? He does all the proper, now I would kill myself if I tried to do it. Like I'd get up there and slip off something and crack my, like it wouldn't be good. But here's the beautiful thing. When I drive home from work, you know, starting whenever it is, November 15th or something, when I come around the corner, I see this boom, this light, this beautiful house. Partly makes sense this time of year, right? Because it gets dark by like 3. In the summer, you wouldn't be able to see these lights till 10 p.m. But now it's like, because of the darkness, the light shines. That's the beautiful part of what Isaiah is saying. It saves, light saves. Of course, John's gospel already told us that the light shone into the darkness, and whether the darkness comprehended or understood it or not didn't change the fact that it shone, but it can change. Lord of the Rings, I've been showing my kids the movies. And we got to the third one where they, of course, they go into the Shelob's lair, the big spider, and it looks hopeless and it's all over and it's dark and Shelob's coming. And then Frodo pulls out the light of the even star that Galadriel gave him. And you can hear her voice when all other lights go out, right? And then my kids are like, woo! Yeah, because he's down. It's over. Like that spider's going to crunch on his face. And then all of a sudden it's legit. Because when you're totally down, knocked out, hopeless, what do you need? When it's dark, you need light. So you don't give up. So all of us have been at those places of darkness and hopelessness at some point in our life. I'll tell you about a couple of mine. When my dad passed away when I was 15, I was lost. I didn't know the meaning of life. I didn't know where this was going. I didn't know where I was going to end up. But I knew that my own father had passed away. And he never even kind of called me and let me know what was happening. There was a time I was supposed to write a book and I was really excited about it. And then my agent fired me for being too loud. It's a long story. I started a church and worked like 70, 80 hours a week for a year. And it was only like 110 people. And I was like, wow, okay, why am I doing this? Have you ever had those? Like, nothing's ever going to change. This stinks. Why am I doing this? Why am I putting all this? It feels hopeless. Maybe that's you. You lost a job. Maybe you lost a parent. Maybe you've been lonely as of late. Your marriage is suffering, or maybe your singleness seems to be going on and on forever. All of those are tough. They all feel like they swallow us up, don't they? What's the solution? Not just to repaint the house or start dressing better or do your makeup because you're feeling down. Or as I read recently, get a dog and kind of pet it so you feel better about yourself. All of that. Those are coping mechanisms, but they don't solve stuff. What's the light here in this text? What's the light at this season of Christmas? It's the light shines in and changes everything. What's the light? To us a child is born, Isaiah says. The only thing that will give you hope, that last, that stands, that matters in the darkest moments. One day a child is going to be born that will save us. So cool. This is the best story, right? So many great stories are waiting to be saved, and the only way we're going to get saved is if a special birth happens, if some king or magical person's going to show up and save us. So 700 years before Jesus, it was like, okay, guys, you got to grasp this. The way the world will get joy and love and faith and hope back in their life is not through a philosophy, not a religion, not a new car, not a promotion, not a perfect marriage, not your kids working out, but through a child being born. And his name is Jesus. This will be the pivot moment in the history of the world. And now we look back 2,000 years ago and we go, yes, that actually happened. If you're young, maybe you don't feel it completely yet. But I was listening to Timothy Keller recently, one of my favorite preachers and thinkers, and he was recently diagnosed, and he knows that in the next year or two or three, he'll be likely passing away. And I was listening to a podcast with him the other day, and he said these words, and it just kind of blew my mind at the moment. He said, I don't want to be relating to Jesus the way I did before I started going through this suffering. It was too shallow. I cherish Jesus now more than ever. And like I feel his glory fall on me in ways that I never did before, in crazy ways. And whatever ends up happening with me, however long I actually end up living, I don't want to go back to a relationship with God that was before I went through this pain and suffering. See, Jesus Christ, how could anyone say any of that? He gives the ultimate peace. That's why. He defeats the stuff we're most afraid of. I was reading a book the other day called A Brief History of Philosophy. And it was talking about the idea that all of philosophy was born out of the deep question of our death. That's our ultimate fear. And we philosophize for thousands of years because we're trying to answer that question deep within our soul, this thing we fear, and Jesus Christ even answers that fear. So who was it? Isaiah 9, his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Prince of Peace. Who was it that brought all of this? Jesus. These are all titles that Jesus came to be known by and fulfilled. He's the child the world was waiting for. He's the one who saves. He's the one who gives life. Your job, here's what we got to understand. Jesus Christ goes to the cross and dies for our sin and rises from death to give us life. Your job can't die for your sin. Your spouse, your success, your money, your reputation, everything going right, your beauty can't give up its life for you, can't give you peace. Only Jesus can do that. But here's the thing. Not everyone necessarily believes that. Like, and maybe you don't, partly because maybe you don't see the difference he made. Skeptics look at the Christmas story maybe, or the idea of God becoming human and said, man, if God showed up, the clouds would roll back, lightning would thunder down, the world would know. But then we look at Christmas, we're like, it's a manger, it's two teenagers. And then a normal guy who didn't even start ministry until he was 30. I mean, it's interesting, I started ministry at 21. So how special is Jesus to have started his ministry later than me? If he really wanted to do a great thing, kill the Roman Empire, ride in and take them over on a big horse, then we'd all believe. I was reading the other day this story about a football game. The team was coming out, and in order to come out, they shot over all these massive jet fighters, and the big parade came out, and all these crazy, like hundreds of people on the field chanting. And then out of this massive thing, the team kind of came out of it, and there was lights and fireworks and music, and the announcer said something like, "That's how God would enter a room." But he didn't, did he? He came as this baby, poor to scared teenagers, probably like 15 years old, Mary and Joseph at the time. Why? Because he was the Prince of Peace. See, this is where we see this isn't just about Jesus, it's about you and me. He brings something. Peace. See, a lot of preaching, even around Christmas, is about Jesus. And yes, of course it is that. But Jesus does something, doesn't he? He's the counselor. He's the Prince of Peace. That's stuff about you and me. What's counselor? It's an image where he's with us, carrying us through this life. He came down and entered into our experience in such a profound way that he can carry us through because he identifies with us. See, this is Jesus. All that expectation came true in him. It actually gives me chills. Does it land on you anymore, or have you just gotten used to it? That the ultimate solution to any of our lostness, our problems, our emptiness, our search is a person, not a job, not a circumstance or whatever. It's a person. And his name is Jesus. Here's the crazy thing. In what form did that hope come for us? It wasn't to give us a bunch of money and change our country politically or jobs or health. It was someone who came to change our spiritual situation. That's exactly what you have. The soul is arguing with itself. Why are you cast down, O my soul? And why are you disquieted within me? And then that psalm, that verse ends with these words, hope in God. That's the best sermon you could preach to yourself this week. Hope in God, three words. I use a lot of words. My sermons are some of you are like, fast forward, hurry up. Best sermon you're going to hear this week, three words, hope in God. Because here's the problem. Without God, man does not have real hope about life or the future at all, as one writer said. Ephesians 2, verse 12 says this, remember that at one time you were separated from Christ, having no hope and without God in the world. See, if you don't believe in Jesus, this is it. The universe is cold and dark and has no point or meaning. So just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. Get as much as you can. Don't sacrifice anything. But then Christmas breaks in and rattles us. See, if you aren't a believer yet, was there an advent or an arrival of something that can give me hope that life is bigger than this? That's the question that's running through your brain. Life is bigger. Could it be true that life is bigger than watching Netflix 3 hours a night when I get home from my job that I kind of like to my marriage, which is average, and my kids who are, you know, kids? Is there someone or something that can give me more in life? The only way to have any hope Ephesians 2 is saying is in God. It's only God. Only by believing in the transcendent versus just this world. He's the only one who brings this in our life. Either there is a God who loves us and made us and gave his life for us, and there's eternity and joy and peace and pleasure, or we came from nothing, we're going nowhere, there's no morality, no purpose, the universe is cold and dark and mean and offers nothing but loneliness and decay. The first story makes me want to get up and go after it every day. Makes me want to fight, makes me want to love, makes me want to sacrifice, makes me want to be courageous. The second story makes me want to hide and be afraid and sacrifice nothing. Years ago, Charles Spurgeon, the great Baptist preacher in London, said that Romans 15, verse 13, was one of the richest passages in the Word of God, he says. Here's what that text says. May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, so that by the power of the Holy Spirit, you may abound in hope. Twice he says hope. But that only happens through God. Hope, 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 only through God. Not through the world. It won't do it. Even if in the face of the thing that scares us the most, we wonder about what's going to give us life, Christmas comes in and says, it's only found in him. He's the one who defeated the loneliness. He's the one who defeated the fear. He reverses it. All the fear, all the idea, he reverses it if you believe. You don't have to be scared at all. Again, it's like why Spurgeon declared, quote, the best moment of a Christian's life is his last one, he said, because it's the one that is nearest heaven. The only people, Spurgeon said, for whom I have felt any envy have been dying members of this very church. See, he solves that ultimate loneliness, right? So hope is used in those three different ways, a desire for something good in the future, but all of those things, though they're found in the Bible, the most important feature of biblical hope is not actually present in any of those examples. Here's the difference. Biblical hope in the person and work of Jesus is about certainty. See, ordinarily, when we express hope, we're expressing uncertainty. I hope she gets home. I hope he gets home. I hope the tailwind. I hope she likes me. I hope they do this. I hope that happens for me. Biblical hope is not a mere desire for something good to happen. This is very important. It's a confident expectation for something good in the future based on who God is. Hope in God, that psalm says, does not mean cross your fingers. It means expect great things from the God who promised them. It's not just a desire for something good in the future, but rather, biblical hope is a confident expectation and desire for something good in the future. Now, that's a fight for all of us to live in light of, right? One of our pastors, Chris DeMonnier, he likes doing martial arts, and he does it all the time, and he's good, and he can beat people up, and he's very strong and has all these weird moves. They can put you in choke holds and like kill you in 10 seconds or whatever. And he comes up to me the other day. He's like, hey, I'm trying to raise some money. You want to get online and we can do like a Facebook Live where you and I fight MMA? What? No. Why would I do that? I haven't punched anything since I punched my cousin, who's a girl, when we were kids, all right? And that felt great, and I'm like, I'm 1-0. That's it. That's how I want to retire, all right? I don't want to do this. That sounds terrible. That's going to be hard. That's going to be difficult. It's going to be painful. It's a fight, man. Keeping hope in our life is a fight every single day. It's tough. It's hard. It's grinding. It's going to hurt. See, all of us, if I face temptation to steal, to lie, to look at, you know, whatever, what's going to get me through and make me not fall to the temptation? The hope that Jesus Christ will give me the ultimate pleasure if I can resist. That's the way I fight for holiness in the Christian life. And the Bible says that's not a cross your fingers kind of hope. It's a sure thing. The assurance of things hoped for, Hebrews 11 says. Not the lip-biting, gaze as you watch the kicker go for a field goal in the last 10 seconds when you're down by 2 points and hope that it works. Bible goes, no, it's about certainty. The conviction of things not seen. It's the thing that does the opposite to shame in our life. It gives us confidence. It doesn't slog your head down, walking around. You're bold because you know a thing. If you know walking into a room that you're going to win a game that's about to be played, maybe you're going to cheat or something. Let's just play that out for you. You know you're going to, so there's a group of people and you know you're going to win because you're going to cheat. You're going to walk in with a swagger. You're going to be like, what's up, players? I'm ready to go. You want to play? You want to play? You want to bet? You see, there's it's a sure thing. That's the confidence it gives you. Think of a kid when they're scared at night. What solves their fear in the end? We lay in bed with them. And so what's solving it? It's presence, yes, but it's something else. It's promised reality that if they wake up at midnight or in the morning, you're going to be there. There's a hope. That's what keeps us going in the end. That's what Christmas answers. Philip Yancey in his book, The Jesus I Never Knew, ends his entire book with these words. I know a woman whose grandmother lies buried under 150-year-old live oak trees in the cemetery of an Episcopal church in rural Louisiana. In accordance with the grandmother's instructions, only one word is carved on her tombstone. Waiting. Indeed, that's hope in a nutshell. Waiting for not the first advent, but the second arrival. See, how is any of this hope actually true? Because not only Christmas is true, right? God becoming human, but where Christmas goes is true. See, even over the Christmas story, Herod kind of casts a shadow, a cross-shaped shadow over the whole story. Because, of course, he's trying to find and kill the Messiah. And that's, of course, where the Messiah's life goes. He dies, ultimately, in our place. And it's only because of that that Christmas is really any good at all. That's where Christmas goes. The hero's not just born, he accomplishes a thing. What he came to do, to give his life as a ransom for many, to pay the penalty that we all deserve of death and hell and the wrath of God. So Christianity in that sense is not something you do, but something done for you. And if that's true, we should all give it a second thought. We should lean in and go, okay, what is this thing? I'm in awe of God. I want to give my life to him. I want his call on my life to be the thing above everything else. John Newton wrote this hymn hundreds of years ago. And in it, he says these words, let us love and sing and wonder. Let us praise the Savior's name. He has hushed the law's loud thunder. He has quenched Mount Sinai's flame. He has washed us with his blood. He has brought us near to God. That's what it does. That's God's work. Christmas is him hunting us down. So when someone asks if you're a Christian, you shouldn't say, well, of course. There's nothing of course-ness about it. Rather, it's a miracle. Yes, I am. It's crazy. I know. I don't deserve it. But he hunted me down and he broke into the world and he suffered for my sake. Miracle of miracles. And that's the hope I hold on to. So if you know all that theologically, you want to bring hope to the world. So we want to be practical this Christmas as a church. There's one of our global partners, Kawasha, which is an amazing work in Uganda, Africa, that takes orphans, kids that don't have fathers, sometimes both parents have died from HIV, AIDS, and educates them, loves them in the ways of Jesus. And we have been partners with them. And they need sponsorships of 150 kids this Christmas season. So we want to cast that vision in front of you. Let's make hope a practical reality in other people's lives. The actual hope that God gives us, we give to others. So our goal is, in the month of December, to sponsor 150 kids. And the amount of people watching this video right now or listening to my voice on podcasts or whatever should know that this is the kind of thing God calls us to, and this should not be a problem to be able to sponsor these 150 kids by the end of December. So if you can do that, go to thisisvillagechurch.com. There'll be a banner, a Kawasha banner at the top of the website. Click there and sponsor a kid. 150, that should not be hard to do even in the next few days. What a time of year to realize that sacrifice is needed on our part to bring hope to the world as well. Let me conclude by reading you a poem by one of my favorite authors, Wendell Berry. He says this. It's three or four paragraphs long, so I just want you to listen to it. So whatever, close your eyes or stare out the window or wherever you're watching this, and just listen to this poem or read it as I read it and take it in yourself. Barry says this: it's hard to have hope. It is harder as you grow old. For hope must not depend on feeling good. And there is the dream of loneliness at absolute midnight. You also have withdrawn belief in the present reality of the future, which surely will surprise us. And hope is harder when it cannot come by prediction any more than by wishing. But stop dithering. The young ask the old to hope. What will you tell them? Tell them at least what you say to yourself, because we have not made our lives to fit our places. The forests are ruined, the fields eroded, the streams polluted, the mountains overturned. Hope. Then to belong to your place by your own knowledge of what it is that no other place is, and by your caring for it as you care for no other place. This place that you belong to, though it is not yours, for it was from the beginning and will be to the end. Belong to your place by knowledge of the others who are your neighbors in it, the old man, the sick, the poor, who comes like a heron to fish in the creek, and the fish in the creek, and the heron who man-like fishes for the fish in the creek, and the birds who sing in the trees in the silence of the fishermen, and the heron and the trees that keep the land. They stand upon as we too must keep it or die. This knowledge cannot be taken from you by power or by wealth. It will stop your ears to the powerful when they ask for your faith, and to the wealthy when they ask for your land and your work. Answer with knowledge of the others who are here. Speak to your fellow humans as your place has taught you to speak, as it has spoken to you. Speak its dialect as your old compatriots spoke it before they had heard a radio. Speak publicly what cannot be taught or learned in public. Listen privately, silently, to the voices that rise up from the pages of books and from your own heart. Be still and listen to the voices that belong to the stream banks and the trees and the open fields. There are songs and sayings that belong to this place. No place at last is better than the world. The world is no better than its places, and its places at last are no better than their people. While their people continue in them, when the people make dark the light within them, the world darkens.